The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
On today's episode, we'll be talking about one of our favorite topics, sex. But not just any sex. We'll be delving into the psychology behind kink and compulsion. A little later on, we'll be speaking to Dr. Nicole Prowse about some new research into sex addiction. But first, we'll welcome back a past guest. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. I'm joined by Jesse Baring, the author of The Belief Instinct and Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? His writing and research have appeared in Slate, Scientific American, New York Magazine, Cosmopolitan, The Guardian, and The New Republic, among other publications. And he's also been featured on NPR, Playboy Radio, and more. Baring is the former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, and he began his career as a professor at the University of Arkansas. He lives in Ithaca, New York. Welcome back to the show, Jesse.
Hi, Desiree. How are you?
I am very well. Thanks for being here, sir. So, sure, your new book, this is lovely. It's titled Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. Now the word itself, perv, pervert, its meaning has evolved over the years, hasn't it?
It really has. The word itself has been around for hundreds of years. I think its first written appearance was in a dictionary in 1624. And at that point, it actually had absolutely nothing to do with sexuality or sexual deviance. To call somebody a pervert really meant that they were a heretic or that they were an atheist, because the word itself meant to go against what is right. And to go against what is right at that point in history meant against biblical scripture or against the word of God, essentially, as it was written in the Bible. So it wasn't until the late 19th century, the Victorian era, when sexologists began using that word pervert, perversion, specifically in the sense of deviant sexuality, to capture this idea that these were types of sexual behaviors or sexual desires that went against what is right, that it really sort of stuck with sexual deviance.
So then when did people start studying sexual deviancy in any scientific way?
Well, I would say that this probably goes back to Richard von Krafft Ebing, who was a psychiatrist in Austria, Germany, living, you know, again, at this period of time in the late 19th century or so. And he began studying sexual deviance from a scientific perspective, really, I think, mostly out of just simple curiosity. He wanted to document the range of sexual variation. But he had a very sort of clinical forensic spin on anything that was outside of the norm. So Krafft-Ebing wrote a very famous book, and it's still in circulation today, called Psychopathia Sexualis. And in this book, he talked about in detail these sort of, you know, really elaborate case studies of people that were exhibiting very unusual sexual behaviors. And I think there was a sort of titillation factor associated with the book. People just wanted to know all the sort of carnivalesque sexual activities that were taking place. But the fact that this was occurring during a period of time when there was tremendous repression of human sexuality, I think is quite interesting.
So if we say that he was taking a look at it from a scientific perspective, what does that mean exactly? What did the early research look like?
You know, he was one of a number of researchers, I suppose, at the time that wanted to understand human sexuality from an amoral, not an immoral, but an amoral, objective, cold, sort of clinical perspective. And in fact, he was quite sympathetic, I think, to people that had unusual sexual interest or engaged in abnormal sexual behavior. He wanted people to understand that they probably had some sort of genetic or hereditary disorder or anomaly that was the impetus or the cause of their behavior. He really was trying to get a handle on the scientific reasons or the causes for their sexuality, these sort of unusual sexual patterns.
So then what was he looking at specifically?
Well, all sorts of things. And this was actually before the word paraphilia was even coined. Paraphilia, which is literally translated to love outside of the norm, wasn't a construct, a recognized construct, until about the 1930s. So when Krafft Ebing was writing about these things in the late 19th century, he was really just kind of documenting strange human sexual behavior. So I'll give you one example that he focused on, which was satyriasis, which he viewed as the male counterpart to female nymphomania. So satyrs were men that had a hypersexual drive. They needed sex more than the average male. They were masturbating more than the average male. They were philandering. And his interpretation of this was basically that they had a genetic disorder. Something was wrong with them. It was a sickness. And we should try to understand them from that perspective, not simply demonize them as a scoundrel, for instance, or a rapist, but to really try to grasp the fact that they were flawed neurologically in some way, although he didn't really understand and didn't really, you know, he didn't have the framework to understand the brain architecture underlying sexual variation at that point.
Well, I find it interesting that's the example you used, because it's definitely women's sexuality that was treated very differently than men's. It seemed like women being overtly sexual at all was considered deviant.
Yes. Any woman that had a pulse, I think, in terms of having any even faint sexual desire was considered a nymphomaniac for a long time.
So then why was women's sexuality medicalized while men's wasn't? Because the satirism that you mentioned, that's pretty much the only example of that, is it not?
That was the exception to the rule, absolutely, because I think that we have a very difficult time looking at male sexual excess as a medical disorder. You know, we basically see men who have too much sex or are cheating on their partners or so on as just being sort of a scoundrel or you know, your average male that somehow fails to get a grip on his own desires. But female sexuality for the longest time, of course, was, as you say, it was medicalized. It was seen as, you know, any woman that was masturbating, that had sexual desire and expressed that in some way, was conceptualized for, you know, a very long time, actually, as being sick, as having an illness, you know, to the extent even that they were institutionalized, you know, and there are actually some cases that I uncovered in the book in the early 1900s where teenage girls that were caught masturbating by their parents, for instance, and the parents were very concerned about this because they viewed this as not appropriate behavior for a teenage girl, brought them into gynecologists at that time and who actually gave them clitoridectomies. You know, this was, they basically gave, you know, it was female genital mutilation. We think of female genital mutilation today as occurring in Africa, for instance, right, and associated with some sort of ritualistic religious behavior. But these were things that were occurring in London and Paris and New York, Manhattan, that were advocated by the mainstream medical establishment.
So now what did early researchers attribute these sexual deviancy issues to? Not just the masturbation, but the paraphilia and all the other wonderful case studies that you cover in this book. What did they attribute that to?
They didn't know. I mean, there was a lot of speculative theory. And for, I'd say, maybe half a century or so, it was clearly dominated by Freudian interpretations, or neo-Freudian interpretations of where these types of unusual patterns of desire came from. So I'll give you one example of people with an amputee fetishism were oftentimes seen as having some sort of lingering. These were men, often, usually. Men who were attracted to women that had a missing leg, for instance. The researchers or the psychoanalysts that were on these cases usually saw this as a manifestation somehow of the castration complex. To give you a really vivid example that I document in the book, there was a case of a man who was attracted to female amputees, and he could actually remember the particular moment in his childhood where he thought, at least, this amputee fetishism actually began. And that was while he was, I think he was 6 or 7, and he was sitting underneath the kitchen table, and the neighbor woman was visiting the home, and she was sitting at the table with her husband. And so it was the three of them alone in the kitchen, the neighbor woman, her husband, and then the little boy sitting underneath the table and kind of playing with his toys. And the interesting thing here is that the neighbor woman had a cast on her leg because she, you know, she was injured in some way. I think she must have broken her leg or something. And the adult couple were having a conversation while the boy was playing underneath the table, and he overheard the man say, "When is it coming off?" And of course, the man was talking about the cast on her leg. But in the boy's mind, he interpreted this as her leg literally coming off. And somehow the fact that he was aroused, you know, he was somehow titillated by this experience of, you know, being under the table, seeing her legs, one in a cast, and hearing this from her husband, somehow in the psychoanalyst's mind meant that he was seeing her as a heroine, a figure that would save him from being castrated by his penis. She was sort of taking the brunt of the castration by having her leg cut off. So as a consequence of that, for the rest of his life, he was attracted to amputated women. That's the type of theoretical model that we've been working right. with for, you know, for a very long time, this sort of Freudian interpretation. And you see that, I mean, that was really frustrating for me as somebody who's not terribly convinced by Freudian theory.
Indeed.
I find it interesting. I find it interesting. But the fact that, you know, this has really permeated the literature for so long, I think is a problem. So for a long time, the early researchers were very much dominated by the Freudian models.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm here with Jesse Baring, the author of Perv, the sexual deviant in all of us. So then how did sexuality research change over the years?
Ultimately, I think, you know, we didn't necessarily abandon Freudian theory, and many, many psychoanalysts today certainly advocate it, but we've moved to a much more biologically oriented model of interpreting human sexuality. The problem with studying the paraphilias is the fact that we can't really get a good sense of the causation or the reasons that one person and not another grows up to be a sexual deviant. And the reason for that is that we can't randomly assign a group of infants, you know, sort of fresh newborn infants to the experimental group where we tinker or manipulate with their early childhood experiences and compare them to a control group who grows up under normal, statistically average conditions and wait, you know, twiddle our thumb for, you know, 16, 17, 18 years and see which of those two groups grows up to be more represented by the sexual deviants or perverts. Of course, that would be an unethical study when we're talking about human research, and most parents wouldn't be very comfortable with volunteering their children for a study on perversions.
I would love to see that try and get past an ethics board.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it is a problem or a research question that could be answered in principle, just methodologically, but ethically we have barriers and hurdles in terms of answering this question. And I think that's probably a good thing, really. So we really have been relying on adults who are openly paraphilic. They have abnormal sexual desires, and we've been relying on their reminiscences or their recollections about when they think their first moment was when they began to realize that they were unusual in terms of their paraphilia or their abnormal desire. And for the most part, taking them at their word, either that or animal studies where we have fewer ethical limitations or constraints in terms of what we can do in, you know, early experiences or ontogeny developmentally and finding out whether, you know, tinkering with their experiences somehow changes their adult sexuality.
So there's obviously problems with both of those kinds of research. The self-reporting relies on trusting an individual to be telling you the truth or telling themselves the truth. And then focusing on animals, that's problematic to extrapolate whatever we learn there to humans, correct?
It is, to assume that, you know, just because a rat, for instance, develops in a particular way, you know, that's the way that a human being would develop sexually as well. You know, there is a really interesting study, however, I should say, where the researchers basically had rat pups suckle from a mother rat, a dam, who had her teats coated with a lemony or a citral scent. And then they waited for those rats to reach reproductive maturity. And they exposed them to adult sort of, you know, reproductive partners. And what was interesting was that the male rats that had suckled as infants or rat pups from this citrus scented mother could only ejaculate, or actually could only get aroused, and of course therefore only ejaculate with female rats that smelled like their lemony scented mothers. They were these sort of lemonophilic adult male rats. What we can make of that, I'm not entirely sure. You know, does that have any sort of translation to human breastfeeding? I think it's interesting, that question, but we don't know the answer to it.
So I think throughout your book, one of the things that becomes very apparent is the fact that there is very little sexuality research around is really the problem.
It's coming along. You know, I think that the most promising areas of research in human sexuality involve not not the sort of self-reports or questionnaires or surveys, which are inherently biased or they're flawed in the sense that, you know, people will only tell you what they think you want to hear or they want you to hear about their sexual reality. You know, we're moving, I think, increasingly away from that as empiricists to models or methods that involve physiological arousal. We're looking at, you know, penile erections or vaginal vasocongestion as reflecting a person's sexual nature. To me, that has much more currency because it addresses the inherent flaws that are associated with people just simply answering questions.
And do tell us about some of that research because it was fascinating.
One of the major differences is the difference between sexes, males and females. What we've discovered, or what actually not what I've discovered, what researchers in this area have discovered, is that males are much more likely to be circumscribed or limited in their sexual arousal response. There's, you know, most men have something that turns them on. It's a recurrent feature, whether it's a particular type of person or a particular act in the sense of behavior. There's a certain thing that the majority of men are attracted to. They're limited in their arousal response to something very specific, in other words. One of the major things that they've found is that men who say that they are heterosexual, for instance, or homosexual, really are in that physiological sense. So a gay man, if you show him images of naked men, he'll get aroused, he'll get an erection. If you show him images of naked women, he remains flaccid. Likewise, if you show a straight man, or a self-identified straight man, an image of another naked man, he remains flaccid. He gets aroused by a naked woman. Now, contrast that with the physiological response or the genital response of your average human female, where you see this sort of arousal to a vast array of erotic stimuli. So a self-identified straight woman, in this sense, will demonstrate genital arousal to other women. A self-identified lesbian will demonstrate genital arousal to men, and they'll both demonstrate arousal to even to non-human species like bonobos, or which is a subspecies of chimpanzee, having graphic sex when they see images of this, or to images of sexual coercion or rape. You know, most women, of course, will tell you that they find rape to be complete anathema, obviously. You know, it's not something that arouses them, but nevertheless, they demonstrate genital arousal to these very disturbing scenes. And the interpretation for this is an evolutionary one, in the sense that women evolved to be hypersensitive to signals of sexual activity or sexuality in the environment because it would have protected their reproductive anatomy if they became lubricated, essentially. Even though they weren't consciously stimulated or aroused by, you know, these types of things in the environment, the fact that if it happened, they would be lubricated served to protect their, you know, their long-term genetic interests. Woman that had some sort of damage to her physical anatomy would be a reproductive dead end, for better or worse. So it's a very mindless sort of reaction, and that's the difference between men and women. That, you know, men are much more aware when they are sexually aroused than women are. With women, there's somewhat of a disconnect between genital arousal and psychological arousal.
So now, what makes that explanation more than just speculation? Is there evidence that would lead us to thinking that was why?
It's an interpretation for a very clear-cut sex difference. And as far as I know, it's the only interpretation that adequately addresses this, you know, this major sex difference. I don't know, you know, if there's any direct evidence that would support this one way or the other, but it's the best interpretation, I think, that we have at the moment for why we see this difference.
Okay, well, let's talk more about the paraphilia research. So is there consensus as to where fetishes come from then? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot of consensus around this area.
Yeah. I heard somebody say, if you can answer that question of where fetishes and paraphilias come from definitively, you'll be famous and rich, because, you know, nobody has actually done that. You know,
right.
All sorts of theories, interpretations, and speculations for where abnormal sexual desires come from, but nobody has really nailed it. And I think, you know, part of it is, of course, that issue that we talked about before, the ethical limitations in addressing this from a scientific, in a controlled scientific way. But there are recurrent patterns that I think, you know, people are beginning to acknowledge as being significant and probably informative. And one is that that paraphilias are overwhelmingly a male phenomenon, which maps onto what I just talked about, you know, the fact that men are much more likely to be locked into a very specific type of stimulus in their environment that they get aroused by, one thing and one thing only that really sort of turns them on, whereas women are more responsive or have the potential to be much more responsive to an array of erotic stimuli, you know, what researchers call erotic plasticity in females. And the one of the really interesting trends to me in the paraphilia research is that a lot of people think that they can pinpoint something that happened to them in their early childhood, mm-hmm. and it's surprisingly early, it's between the ages of 4 and 9 actually, that set them on course for this abnormal pattern of desire. You know, I gave the example already of the man with the amputee fetishism, but there are plenty of other things as well that, that people can oftentimes recollect or recall as being sort of the prime mover of their paraphilia. And again, it's mostly a male type of phenomenon.
Well, now, we probably should point out that what's considered a fetish is also very dependent on culture, correct?
It is, absolutely. You know, the issue, you know, one of the major issues that I wanted to deal with in the book is this concept, I suppose, of cultural relativism. What is normal in one society is completely exotic in another, when we're talking about sexuality, at least. So when we are trying to, you know, come up with some sort of definition of normal human sexuality, we definitely run into these major hurdles. However, you know, having said that, certainly heterosexual behavior where we're attracted to reproductively aged adults and we have intercourse, and I'm saying this as a gay man, so it's not necessarily this doesn't apply to me. That is something that we find recurrently across human societies. And, you know, that makes sense from a relatively obvious, clear-cut evolutionary biological framework. You know, otherwise, the population would dwindle in the sense of actual human reproduction.
This is Science for the People, and we'll get right back to Jesse Baring and his book, Perv, after these messages.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Jesse Baring, the author of The Belief Instinct, Why is the Penis Shaped Like That?, and the new book, Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. So let's be clear, most paraphilias aren't really considered harmful, right?
That's right. I mean, they're really all across the board. And at last count, there were 547 distinct or discrete paraphilias. You know.
No. You got to stop.
And
there.
Some of them.
Wait. Like what? For example, I do have to.
Well,
ask that.
Some of them are incredibly rare. You know, maybe one or two people in the entire world actually could be characterized as having melissophilia, for instance, which would be an attraction to stinging insects, you know, or formicophilia, which would be actually having to have the insects on ants or beetles on your erotic zone somehow in order to achieve sexual gratification, or lithophilia, people who are attracted to stones and gravel, climacophilia, people that can only have an orgasm while falling down the stairs. You know, they're all over the place.
I'm sorry. I'm just wondering about the logistics of that, but that's fair. Okay.
So. Well, yeah, ideally, you know, you're going to have a really long stairwell that would prolong the orgasm, or, you know, you don't want to live in a one-story house. But there are people, and there are documented case studies that actually go into detail about these people's private sexual lives. You know, I thought at the beginning that, you know, these people, there's no way these people actually exist. This must be just simply rumors or urban legends about sexual variation. But, you know, if you look at the actual clinical literature, you'll find people that have, you know, fit these fit the bill for these really unusual types of sexual profiles. I remember reading one about a guy that was a sneeze fetishist. I talk about him in the book, actually. He could only get aroused if he heard... He was a homosexual sneeze fetishist, so he liked other men that sneezed in a particular fashion, which was a sort of fusillade of sneezes in rapid succession, that sort of sneezing style. And he thought this made this sort of sneezing pattern made a man attractive, so he sought out a man that sneezed a lot. And unfortunately, that relationship didn't last very long, because the man with the sneeze fetish actually got jealous of his sneezing style, and he couldn't replicate it. And he was copying him, and it was just a little bit high maintenance, I suppose. As bizarre as it sounds, these people really do exist.
But that's something that you do a wonderful job of in the book. We may make light of this, and some of these examples may be giggle-inducing, but the thing is this makes life difficult for people. And you actually used the example of a slot machine in terms of your sexuality.
You know, I really want to get the idea across that we have zero control over our singular erotic profile. You know, basically we each have a fingerprint in terms of the types of things that arouse us. And first of all, it's very important to distinguish between desire as a psychological state and behavior, acting on those desires. And I think that's absolutely paramount when we're thinking in moral terms about what is okay or acceptable or appropriate in human sexuality. But yes, I use the example of a slot machine to sort of get this idea across. And there would be sort of four, if you envision your average slot machine, you go into Las Vegas or something and you see this machine, there would be four slot windows. In that first window, we would find our, sort of what we would consider to be sort of sexual orientation in the mainstream, gay, straight, bi, or asexual. Asexuals are people who say that they are not aroused by males or females. And then we move on to the next slot machine window, and we find a particular activity that we really sort of are aroused by the most as individuals. You know, whether this is regular intercourse or a paraphilic type of sexual behavior, which would be, something like exhibitionism or voyeurism or frotterism, which is touching people in public for sexual arousal, whatever it happens to be, that goes into that second slot window. The third slot window would represent our particular erotic target, for lack of a better word. The erotic target would be the type of entity, I suppose, in the environment that makes us aroused, more than anything else. So this would be a human being for the vast majority of people, but for some people that have different types of sexuality, it would be an inanimate object, or it could be an animal for people that are technically zoophiles, people who are more aroused by other species than the human species, and they really do exist. And then finally, in that last slot machine window, would be the erotic age orientation, the age of the individual, at least if we're attracted to human beings, that most arouse us in terms of their physical sort of reproductive characteristics. And there are four levels of the erotic age orientation. Scientists are now unraveling this sort of interesting concept. There's the traditional, I suppose we use this term very, very casually, but pedophile. A pedophile is somebody technically who is aroused by somebody, a child who is prepubescent. But then there's the hebephile. The hebephile is aroused by children or young adolescents that sort of are at the brink, just that sort of threshold of adolescence or puberty. And the most obvious example, I think, of this, or the best example, would be Lolita, the famous book by Vladimir Nabokov that suggests that people are most aroused by this sort of turning stage or chrysalis moment in human sexuality. The ephebophiles are those who are aroused mostly by older adolescents, so just ballpark, maybe 15, 16, 17-year-olds and so on. Teleophiles are attracted to your average reproductively aged adults. And then the gerontophiles are attracted to the elderly. And those are the four slot machine windows that, you just sort of pull that lever, and whatever you get in terms of the distribution of traits that map onto those four windows or behind those four windows is who we are as individuals, as sexual human organisms. And we have no control over that. What we do have control over is what we do with that singular erotic profile.
Well, and just to clarify that, so what is a jackpot? in your illustration?
Well, the jackpot with the slot machine, you know, sort of pulling the lever and really sort of hitting the jackpot would be different across human societies, would be different across human eras. Whatever is idealized as the best or most appropriate or most moral type of sexual pattern would be the jackpot. In our own society, of course, it would be straight people who are attracted to human beings that are most aroused by having standard missionary, you know, intercourse with them, and they happen to be of reproductive age and also aligned with our legal age in terms of being adults. That's the jackpot today.
And so every window that does not match up with that, life is going to be harder.
It lends itself, I think, to difficulties, frustrations, anxiety, paranoia, personal distress, as that term is used in the psychiatric or clinical literature. Yes, absolutely.
Now, this is one of the fields that I find it interesting because there has been a certain amount of research done on pedophilia. But it's a catch-22 to try to do this research in the first place, correct?
It's a catch-22 in the sense that it's very difficult to do it outside of a forensic psychiatric framework. You know, most of the people that are involved as participants in pedophilia studies, of course, are going to be those that have been anonymously outed by the authorities for some reason because they've committed some crime. You know, they've actually harmed a child or they've engaged in some sort of hands-off sexual offending behavior such as, you know, child pornography. And clinicians are trying to diagnose them really with pedophilia to ascertain the likelihood of them committing some sort of sexual transgression in the future. So it's a catch-22 in the sense that we don't have a good sense of just how many people in the general population would be characterized, you know, on these different sort of erotic age orientation, you know, on that spectrum, how many pedophiles, how many hebephiles, how many ephebophiles, how many teleophiles, how many gerontophiles are actually out there. Because, you know, given the current status of, you know, society and what we really like to demonize today, you know, few people that aren't already in the system, in the sense of some sort of, in the legal sense anyway, are going to readily volunteer themselves for these types of studies.
And if they did, the researchers would be bound by confidentiality, of course.
Yeah, so, you know, it's very difficult to study. I mean, there are ethical problems, I think, on both ends. You know, on the one hand, you've got people that, you know, if you're a true pedophile or a true hebephile or something like that, which is obviously frowned upon, to put it lightly, by the rest of society, you're not going to, you know, volunteer for a study where you're going to be sort of identified as such. But even if a researcher or a scientist was able to clearly identify or to clearly get a general sample from the population for a study like this, and they found that, you know, there are these people that, you know, that haven't committed any crimes, but nevertheless they're responding sexually to images of children, and those participants happen to, I don't know, they're teachers or they're counselors with children or something like that. Right. There's a burden on the part of the researcher in that case to somehow notify the authorities, or at least lots of people would think this, because if that person actually did sexually molest or abuse a child, it would be their fault because they didn't bring this to the attention of the authorities. So yeah, that's the catch-22, I think, of just getting an accurate percentage of people that would fall into these types of categories in the general population.
So then what does that mean for diagnosis and treatment?
Well, there's no good, I mean, you know, if you look at erotic age orientations, and I think there's every reason that we should look at them this way, as equivalent in terms of orientation, like, you know, being homosexual or heterosexual or bisexual or asexual, you can't change it. And I think that becomes, you know, it's relatively easy to understand because, you know, for most of us, you know, we can't just simply become attracted to an 8-year-old. We can't choose to be attracted to an 8-year-old and therefore, you know, be a pedophile. We can't choose to be attracted to an 85 or a 90-year-old and to be a gerontophile. These are things that are beyond, you know, conscious deliberation or choice by the people that are actually represented, you know, with these types of, you know, arousal patterns. So you can't change it. What you can do, especially for orientations, erotic age orientations like true pedophilia, where somebody who has already harmed a child, is to administer some sort of a psychotropic or psychopharmacological treatment that, you know, basically chemically castrates them Depo Provera is one of them, it will diminish entirely their libido. So they become asexual. You know, they have no attraction to anything. And that's really the only treatment that we have. There's no conversion for pedophiles, for instance. You know, there's no conversion from pedophilia to teleophilia. That's just not something that seems to be possible.
Now, here's where it starts to get mighty awkward. Because how do we judge our age of consent laws? What are they based on?
I think that we have a sort of an intuition or a gist sense of, you know, the average age, you know, or the sort of relative age where sexual consent with older partners is permissible or isn't going to cause any sort of lasting damage or harm. But the fact that, you know, there really is such tremendous variation in age of consent laws cross-culturally, and it goes all the way from 12 to 21, even in the modern era, tells us something about the fact that, you know, it really relies and depends on what a particular society or population believes is true about human sexuality. And, you know, we've seen tremendous fluctuation even in our own, you know, in the West, we've seen tremendous fluctuation even in our own age of consent laws. It's mind-boggling, really, but to think that long after the Civil War, the age of consent in the U.S. was closer to 12 or 13. In fact, there was one state where it was unbelievably as low as 7 in Delaware. No idea what was happening at that point. That tells us that we've really sort of revamped our understanding of development in children and sexuality. You know, whether 18 is the right age or 16, you know, no matter, you know, depending on where you are, there's a bit of arbitrariness there. So yeah, it's uncomfortable, and it doesn't always map on very clearly to actual harm experienced by the minor.
There are so many things that you covered in the book that we don't have time to talk about, if there's a bigger word than fascinating, I'd use it right now. It was brilliant. But so at this point, what is normal? What is normal sexuality? Does that exist? Is anyone measuring that?
I do think that there really is a normal sexuality, and it would map onto or relate to what most of us would consider to be a vanilla heterosexuality. But normal is not very interesting. What's normal is not interesting as a question, because it simply reflects a statistical majority. Most of the people in society are doing this, therefore it's normal. But to say that normal has any sort of moral relevance is quite a stretch. There's no intrinsic morality in the number of normality. And I also think it's not very interesting to ask what's natural. And that's something that I try to dig into the book. You know, what's natural is also a fairly meaningless question. Because, you know, at this point, if we are scientifically literate, the issue of what's natural is simply, what works in terms of reproductive success. There's an evolutionary significance, or there's currency to that question when we ask what is natural. But unless we want to envision some sort of intelligent designer that crafted our genitalia to do one thing and not another thing, what's natural really is meaningless as well. There are lots of things that are natural, in fact, that with human beings and other species that we don't really want to engage in because they cause harm. Harm, to me, is really the most important question. You know, what's harmful? And so I don't want to give the impression that what's harmful is an easy question to answer, but I do think that that is the question that we should be spending more time on, to really understand from the perspective of people that have very different sexual desires and orientations as ourselves, what is harmful in the context of their particular dynamic or interaction with others. That, to me, you know, really sort of grappling with this issue of harm is where we're going to make some moral progress in relation to issues concerning human sexual diversity.
Well, and you make the point throughout your book, and actually even right there in the title, that really we're all perverts. So what do you want us to take from that?
I think we need to be less judgmental, certainly, of people that have desires or feelings that are, you know, lusting after things that we find particularly aversive or even disgusting. I think disgust is, you know, I say in the book, you know, disgust is the blind visceral engine of hate. You know, when we find something disgusting sexually, our logical abilities, our rational faculties are completely swamped with these feelings, these really sort of powerful feelings. And we basically just stop there. We say it's wrong because it's gross or it makes us disgusted. We have a difficult time taking the perspective, as I just mentioned, of others in terms of their particular subjective experience with what arouses them sexually. The sexual deviant in all of us really sort of hints at this idea that it's disgusting or it's wrong or it feels aversive to me in some way, but that doesn't mean that it's universally wrong or has any sort of implications for our moral evaluation of the harmfulness of the acts that we're evaluating. So we stop oftentimes with simply that gut, you know, that sort of instinctive feeling of what turns us off, and we assume that it must turn other people off as well. But, you know, we really need to escape that cognitive bias, that sort of powerful emotional reaction to conceptualizing sexual behavior and sexual desires that are very foreign to us. If we're trying to evaluate them in any sort of moral way, we need to do our best, at least, to put ourselves into the shoes of those that have these types of feelings and to take them at their word when they say that they're harmed or they're not harmed. To me, that's where, you know, that's really where we're going to be making any sort of meaningful headway in these types of conversations. So sometimes, you know, we are really taxed and burdened and pushed into a corner to be intellectually consistent when we are thinking about these types of topics, morality and sexuality. But we can't trust our stomachs. You know, we can't be stomach philosophers in our conceptualizing human sexuality from a moral type of framework. We really need to go outside of that box and to be as logical as we possibly can in thinking about sexual deviance. So be as deviant as you want, in other words, and let other people be as deviant as they want, as long as they are not causing any demonstrable harm. And if they're not causing demonstrable harm, and we, you know, we reject them anyway, we ostracize them, we don't allow them into the human circle, we're the bad guys in that scenario. We're not the good guys.
Jesse, always wonderful to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can find a link to Jesse Baring and his book, Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. This is Science for the People, and we'll be back to talk with Dr. Nicole Prowse about sex addiction after these messages.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at the math and science of business decisions. We'll speak to David McAdams, Duke University Professor of Business Administration and Economics, about his book Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations. And we'll talk to Stanford Economics Professor Benjamin Ho about his economic analysis of apologies. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my next guest today is Dr. Nicole Prowse, Assistant Research Scientist in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a Research Scientist at the Mind Research Network. She's studying the connection between the brain and the genitalia, and she's especially interested in what makes otherwise rational people decide to take sexual risks. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
So you just published a study that tested the brain's response to sexual stimuli among a group of individuals who identified as having problems controlling their use of online pornography. So maybe can you just take us through that?
Sure. In this study, we had 52 people who reported having problems regulating their viewing of sexual images and had them view a series of pictures, some of which were erotic, others were pictures of mutilated bodies, others were other very happy images of sports, skydiving, these types of things. And it's very standard protocol. What we were looking for in this study was a particular part of the brain response, commonly called a P300. And this is how large the brain responds to those different types of pictures. And in many studies of substance use problems, people have enhanced P300 responses to pictures of the drug they're having problems with. So if people who have problems regulating their viewing of sexual images look like people who have substance use problems, they should have had enhancement that was similar to the level of problem they were having with the erotica. And we had a number of different questionnaire measures looking at the amount of problems they reported, and that was not related to their brain's response to the sexual images. The only thing that was related was the level of sexual desire that they reported. So what the study suggested to us was the brain's response to erotica was strongly determined by their level of sexual arousal or sexual desire, but was not related to any of three different measures of sexual problems, such as sexual compulsivity or sexual addiction, some would say.
First of all, how did you select those participants?
It was a two-stage process. We had advertisements that asked people to volunteer if they felt they were having problems regulating their viewing of sexual images.
Okay, so self-reported.
And so initial stage was self-report. Okay. But we realized, especially where we were living at the time, in a conservative part of Southeast Idaho, that some people might consider even viewing the images in the first place to be a problem.
Ah.
And we wanted to make sure we weren't getting just those folks, that they were having some real consequences and significant problems. So we screened them then on a series of questionnaires before they were allowed to participate in the actual study. And we wanted people who varied. You know, some of them had significant problems, but that were less severe than other participants who had very severe problems. So that was our two stage. It was one, they had to feel that they themselves had a problem, and then they actually had to quantitatively verify that in some way.
And you tested both men and women.
Yes, and as with this population generally, we had primarily men come in, but we did have a subset of women in that group.
Why would you show people static images and not pornography, like, for example, the kind that you would find on the internet?
This raises two issues. The stimuli we use, of course, is very important in trying to interpret what ultimately happened in the brain. And on the one hand, you're absolutely right. Most people looking on the internet at erotica these days are probably not just looking at pictures.
Right.
They have high bandwidth, they have speed, they can get the videos for free anytime, no problem. Because of that, we also collected brain response data to sexual films, and those data are currently under review. So we can't speak to them yet because they haven't been published. But we did have that in mind. And the other question is, are these images that even appeal to the particular people that come in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that something that they particularly like? And does that matter? And I think that's a kind of a next step question. So we took a more conservative approach of initially showing people standardized images to look at just how their brain compared to the responses of the brains of people who have seen these same erotic images across the world. So we got the images that we used from two sources. Half of the sexual images came from what's called the International Effective Picture System, which is a very commonly used database of images that's used by neuroscientists across the world. But these are pretty milquetoast images. They're not very explicit. You can't really see penetration in any of them. So we were concerned they wouldn't even hold a candle to what is typically easily accessible. So we supplemented these with a database of pictures from where else? The Netherlands, in a study that they had conducted, that they were kind enough to allow us access to those images. So we ended up with some sexual images that are very widely used and very well standardized, and half the sexual images that were a bit more explicit, that we thought might be more representative, but that were a bit less standardized.
So you say that there is a significant difference between the response to sexual imagery in people that that are considered hypersexual or sex addicts than you would see in other addictions. So what's your interpretation of why that would be?
I believe that people who are reporting problems regulating their viewing of sexual images are not addicted to them. Now, some people have said, well, then what is it? Are these people lying? Are they just jerks and they are justifying their behaviors? Or could it be that it's something else? And we don't know. I think this points us towards at least possibly ruling out an addiction model, But there's still the possibility, aside from them being jerks, of them having problems with compulsion, say, or problems with impulsivity related to their viewing, or perhaps something else we haven't thought of yet. So it doesn't mean that there is no pathology, but it's not consistent with an addiction pathology.
Well, that's interesting because those findings do pretty much run counter to everything we traditionally thought about hypersexuality, correct?
You know, it's funny. There's a large divide between the media and scientists. So if you look in the media, absolutely, it seems like everyone is talking about sex addiction. But then those of us that are in the scientific field are looking like, where are they getting this from? Because it's actually very uncommon for scientists to use the word addiction to refer to these problems. It's much more common to talk about just hypersexual behaviors, maybe, or high sexual motivation. So I think it's a split. It's really not an accepted scientific phenomenon. And so it's not something that's been studied widely, I think, because we just see that as, oh, you know, that's something the magazines talk about, or it's something the celebrities talk about. We don't do that. But at some point, I think we have to pay attention and say, if people are talking about it, we need to do something to test and address those, even if it's maybe not our what's currently in vogue in science.
Is anybody disagreeing with your study or with your interpretation or anything of that sort?
Interestingly, they haven't disagreed with any of the basic science approach. So, for instance, our statistics or our signal processing, those things that scientists might go after have not been questioned. But a number of people have come after it questioning the interpretation. So, for instance, some people have claimed that by virtue of having gotten our sample from Idaho, the study is invalid. Exactly.
Okay.
So the question is, well, how does having a sample from Idaho make the result invalid? And those things are difficult to respond to because it's not a clear critique. My impression is what I think they're, in that case, trying to critique is that the sample might be biased or skewed in some unusual way. But, you know, what we saw, there were tons of groups for treating sex addiction in Pocatello, Idaho, where we collected the sample. And by and large, those groups look a lot like samples from other places where research is conducted on the same types of population. So there are, you know, a higher belief in religious values. There's more attendance at religious services in both the people that we surveyed in our study and in people who report these type of problems in general. So I do think, for instance, it's a biased sample, but I think it's exactly biased in the way it should be to accurately reflect the people who go into treatment.
And of course, we would love this study replicated hundreds of times in order to provide more evidence. And I think that probably goes without being said. But
thank you for saying.
Yes.
That.
But that being said, so what would this mean for the treatment model of hypersexuality, and especially people that are currently being treated?
So if the study is replicated, it means the treatment approaches that are using an addiction model are probably not being very effective. So, for example, if you take the substance addiction model and do 12-step, and there are many, many treatments now using 12-step mm-hmm. for sex addiction, they preach abstinence, initially at least, from sexual behavior, period. No masturbation, no sex with your partner. I mean, they vary, certainly, to some extent. I don't want to pin them all down, but you know, when I was a clinician trying to do couples therapy, if you had someone that came in and was engaged in those kind of treatments, you were going to have significant problems doing couples treatment because, you know, this should be something they're doing together and enjoying together. And all of a sudden, this treatment conflicts. And it's just not clear that that was even an appropriate treatment to begin with. So, you know, there is the possibility of doing harm with treatment. And I think largely, clinicians don't want to believe that they're harming patients, but there is that risk. If you're using a treatment model that hasn't been shown to work, that's not appropriate, you can harm your patients. And that, to me, is a great motivation for continuing to do work in this area and something we should be concerned about if the study is replicated.
So then what is the difference between the treatment model for addictions and the treatment model for, I believe you said, compulsions?
it is hard to talk about the difference in models broadly because it depends kind of how they manifest. So if you think about a compulsion model, generally we're thinking along the lines of OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorders, where, you know, it may be that they're just getting into a repetitive behavior and doing it in a way without thinking, but it's not that they're unable to control. You know, it's the nature of the problem has shifted. So it may not be that you need to have complete abstinence from sex. And in fact, maybe that's harmful. But, or, you know, with erotica, maybe it's not that you can never see a sexual image again or you have to stay off the internet entirely, but that you need to find some replacement behavior. Or, you know, we can look maybe to OCD models of treatment and draw on those more strongly and maybe have better efficacy in helping people who want help reducing their erotica use.
So then the question is, beyond the replication, where do you go from here? Where do we go from here?
We've gone a number of different directions to try and explore some of these potential issues. One of the things we're pursuing is the film data I mentioned. So actually showing people who report this problem erotic films and seeing if they're tracking in the same way, if their attention looks the same as people who don't have problems in these areas. We have another study under review. As you might imagine, you know, this study that came out just had people who reported problems. Well, we have a very large sample of controls, of course, and we also want to look at specifically how they compare to controls who don't report having that problem, and we have those data under review as well. Some of the things I'd like to do in the future are this group also often clinically is reported as not experiencing orgasm as satisfying, or they'll say, you know, they get very temporary relief and immediately are seeking out sexual stimuli again. If that's the case, we can measure that. We can have them orgasm and we can look at whether their brain is responding in a way that's similar to people that don't report having this problem. For instance, if they are as rewarded by orgasm as other people, if they reach as high a state of arousal, if they're actually having orgasms, you know, there are lots of questions in there that we just don't know the answer to. So we actually had applied to do this study at UCLA to look at people's orgasm response in the laboratory, monitoring their brain at the same time. And the study was stopped. The ethics board refused to let it run. It's the second time in the history of UCLA that that's occurred, to my knowledge. And they refused basically the orgasm component, you know, said repeatedly if we didn't take it out, they wouldn't approve it. And that was the primary part of the study. So, of course, we couldn't take it out. So there are challenges to doing this type of work that are unusual, to say the least.
Can I just ask, on what grounds would they refuse an orgasm study?
The grounds that they cited during the review were that they didn't feel the orgasm task was necessary, but they would not say why. And we couldn't get a more specific answer than that, basically, after, you know, six rounds of asking them to specify why it was a problem so that we could respond to it. They ultimately rejected it on technical grounds that were new to us and had not been raised previously. So basically, you know, we heard one thing during the review, but then they knew they couldn't reject it on that ground, so they had to come up with different grounds, and that's what they did.
And this is something that we've come across a number of times on Science for the People. We constantly talk about replication being the key to providing more substantial evidence, but there are so many barriers and obstacles to getting funding and approval for a lot of these studies in the first place.
Absolutely. The case with sexuality studies, it's even more important to have feasibility data for grant applications to show, because people are oddly skeptical to me. You know, they don't believe that people would participate in this kind of study. They see it as filthy or unethical in some way, like inherently unethical. And that was part of the challenge we faced with this exact study is, you know, we can't apply for grant funds or really move forward unless we can collect pilot data, and we're unable to collect pilot data at our institution. So we've currently gone to a second site. So these data are being collected at the University of Pittsburgh, but hopefully we'll be able to talk about them from there at some point in the future. It's tough to do. You know, again, just the funding situation is such that the federal government is completely skittish about funding something like this, even if it's relevant for curbing HIV transmission. it really seems not to matter. They're very nervous to put money behind something that they perceive as controversial, even though it's commonly done in other countries. And, you know, the U.S. is falling behind in science because of this, at least in this area. So it's frustrating, but we're trying to persevere and find ways of getting the good work done.
Keep fighting the good fight, Nicole.
That's what it feels like.
Thanks so much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
And we'll link to Nicole Prowse and her research on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're there, please do click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can follow program updates, and the link to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.